The headlines, U.S. officials say the White House will soon announce a new military aid package for Ukraine, which includes a Patriot missile battery and precision-guided bombs for fighter jets. An investigation reveals Twitter worked with the Pentagon to amplify propaganda about U.S. military activities in the Middle East, allowing fake accounts to push pro-Washington narratives. And also in our headlines, the Taliban ban university education for Afghan women, drawing strong condemnation from the international community. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. The U.S. is set to announce an additional military aid package for Ukraine, despite Russia's warnings against the delivery of advanced equipment to Kiev. According to U.S. officials, a $1.8 billion worth of new military aid will for the first time include a Patriot missile battery and precision-guided bombs. The officials described the details of the package. On condition of anonymity, the U.S. has already provided Ukraine with more than $19 billion in military aid. Russia had earlier warned the U.S. against sending such advanced military equipment to Ukraine. Moscow said it would consider the move as a provocative step and that the equipment would be a legitimate target. Meanwhile, the White House says the Ukrainian president will meet his American counterpart Joe Biden and address Congress today. Zelensky's visit to Washington is his first trip abroad since Russia launched its military offensive in Ukraine in February. While strikes over pay and working conditions keep widening in the UK, now ambulance workers, including paramedics and call handlers, have joined the industrial action. New walkouts have prompted warnings from healthcare leaders. At least three ambulance services, however, say they would prioritize treatment for those most in need. The government plans to replace 750 military personnel to drive ambulances and perform logistics roles. The strike comes a day after nurses took to the picket lines for the second time, paralyzing the National Health Service. The increasing costs of food and energy have angered workers in various public and private sectors. The walkouts have intensified just days before Christmas. Railway workers and passport control officers have also threatened they would ruin the holiday season if their demands are not met. An opinion poll shows two-thirds of Britain support strikes over the pay dispute. European households and industries are suffering from soaring energy bills, with some businesses being forced to close down. Now, a new report suggests this is just the beginning of Europe's deepest crisis in decades. According to the report, the skyrocketing energy prices triggered by the war in Ukraine have cost Europe nearly $1 trillion.
The skyrocketing energy prices have cost Europe nearly $1 trillion, according to a new report stating that the current situation as the fallout of the war in Ukraine is just the beginning of the deepest crisis in decades. Citing its calculations based on market data, a report published in Bloomberg said $1 trillion is a broad tally of more expensive energy for consumers and companies in European countries. However, that's just the beginning. After this winter, the region will have to refill gas reserves with little to no deliveries from Russia, intensifying competition for tankers of the fuel. Even with more facilities to import liquefied natural gas coming online, the market is expected to remain tight until 2026, when additional production capacity from the US to Qatar becomes available. That means no respite from high prices. The report also referred to more than $700 billion pledged by the European Union governments to protect consumers and companies from soaring prices, noting that aid is becoming increasingly unaffordable as interest rates are rising and economies are already in recession amid the war in Ukraine. Government fiscal capacity is already stretched. About half of European Union member states have debt exceeding the bloc's limit of 60% of gross domestic product. A rush to fill storage last summer, despite near-record prices, has eased the supply squeeze for now, but freezing weather is giving Europe's energy system its first real test this winter. Last week, Germany's network regulator warned that not enough gas is being saved and two of five indicators, including consumption levels, have become critical. With supply tight, businesses and consumers have been asked to reduce usage. According to the International Energy Agency, the EU managed to curb gas demand by 50 billion cubic meters this year. But the region still faces a potential gap of 27 billion cubic meters in 2023. that assumes Russian supplies drop to zero and Chinese LNG imports return to 2021 levels. The main source of pipeline gas from Russia to Western Europe was Nord Stream, which was damaged in an act of sabotage in September. The region is still receiving a small amount of Russian supplies through Ukraine, but heavy shelling of energy infrastructure by the Kremlin puts the route at risk. Without this gas line, refilling storage will be challenging. Also, LNG imports into Europe are at record levels and new floating terminals are opening in Germany to receive the fuel.
A new investigation shows Twitter helped the U.S. military amplify its online propaganda campaigns about its activities in West Asia. The probe was carried out by a journalist based on an internal documents released by Elon Musk, who took over as Twitter CEO in October. It reveals that Twitter created a special whitelist in 2017 to grant accounts run by the U.S. Central Command more visibility. In some cases, the accounts even used fake profiles and bios to give the impression that they were run by civilians in West Asia. At the top of the campaign's agenda was spreading criticism of Iran and showing support for the U.S.-backed and Saudi-led war on Yemen. The journalists found that the collusion continued until at least May of this year. For years, Twitter has claimed that it deletes any government-backed covert propaganda campaigns worldwide. And Peru has ordered the Mexican ambassador to leave the country as the diplomat spat deepens between the two countries.
The government of Peru has declared Mexico's ambassador to Peru, Pablo Monroy Conesa, persona non grata because of the repeated statements from the highest authorities of that country regarding the political situation in Peru. They constitute interference in our internal affairs, and therefore they violate the non-intervention principle. We have delivered him a diplomatic letter through which we notified him he has 72 hours to abandon national territory.
The row followed Mexico's offer of asylum to the family of ousted Peruvian President Pedro Castillo. His family is already in the Mexican embassy in Lima. Neither Mexican nor Peruvian officials have given any timeline when the family will travel to Mexico City. Castillo was removed from office and arrested nearly 2 weeks ago after he attempted to dissolve Congress to avoid his impeachment. He is in the pretrial detention for 18 months for alleged rebellion and conspiracy. Deputy protests erupted following his arrest in an attempt to defuse the political crisis. Peru's Congress has endorsed a plan to hold an early election. Elections for president and Congress have moved up from originally 2026 to April 2024. Well, Afghanistan's de facto Taliban government has banned university education for women nationwide. The Taliban authorities have informed all government and private universities that female education is suspended until further notice. The ban comes less than 3 months after the university entrance exams were held across the war-torn country. The universities are currently closed for winter break. The Taliban had blocked girls from secondary school education in March. Meanwhile, the UN chief said he was deeply alarmed by the ban. A spokesman for Antonio Guterres described the Taliban's move as a violation of equal rights for women and girls, saying it will have devastating impact on the country's future. Since returning to power in last August, the Taliban have been facing criticism for restricting women and from education and jobs. Elsewhere, Iran's foreign ministry strongly denounces a recent meeting between former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and the leader of the Mojahedin-e-Khalq terrorist group known as the MKO. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the meeting further proves Washington's cooperation with the murderers of 17,000 Iranians. The Iranian official said by whitewashing terrorism and shamefully sanctifying the MKO leader, U.S. officials have laid bare the false face of American human rights. Kanani said the U.S. appeal to the MKO terrorists is aimed at exerting pressure on the Islamic Republic. He said the White House will remain legally and internationally responsible for violating the rights of Iranians. In a meeting with the MKO's leader on Saturday, Pompeo reiterated support for the terrorist group. The former U.S. Secretary of State picked the leader of the terrorist group as Iran's president. Iran has announced plans to expand its nuclear energy program in line with its rights under the JCPOA. That's as the Vienna talks over the revival of the 2015 deal has faced a standoff. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Iran's nuclear chief announced this week that the capacity of uranium enrichment in the country is now twice as high as the total volume produced since the onset of the nuclear industry in Iran. He made the remarks in an exhibition showcasing Iran's latest achievements in the nuclear sector.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology.
This is one of the achievements Iran has publicized in recent days, which is viewed as a response to what Tehran describes as the West dilly-dallying on the revival of the 2015 deal. The pact has been in limbo since the U.S. walked out of it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran.
The Americans claim that the Vienna talks are no longer a priority for them amid the unrest in Iran. First of all, they have a role in engineering the riots. Secondly, they do want to resume the negotiations, but they are trying to use the unrest as a bargaining chip in the talks.
In October this year, Iran deployed more advanced centrifuges at its three enrichment facilities, increasing their total number to 4,000. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced this week that it's now enriching uranium at a historic 60% rate using the new advanced centrifuges.
As hopes for the revival of the 2015 deal dwindle, Iran says it reserves its right to boost its nuclear energy program, which it says is clearly stipulated in the accord. The AEOI says it will not wait for the resumption of the Vienna talks and will continue to expand its nuclear activities for peaceful purposes. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Cancer-stricken Palestinian prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid has died in an Israeli jail despite long-standing calls for his release. General strikes and a day of anger has been declared in the West Bank following his death. Mona Candil has more from Ramallah.
Another Palestinian prisoner seen by many here as a hero and an icon died in an Israeli jail. Cancer-stricken prisoner Nasser Abu Ahmed, the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah, died early Tuesday as the Israeli authorities refused to release him alive despite growing calls for his release following his late diagnosis with cancer more than a year ago. Nasser was arrested at the end of the Second Intifada in 2002. He was sentenced to 7 life sentences and another 50 years for deadly operations he carried out and organized.
I visited Nasser yesterday in hospital when his health was deteriorating. I recited verses of Quran for him because I knew it was going to be the last time I see him. Nothing will relieve us now but to have Nasser's body and hold his funeral procession and burial ceremony here. I don't want Nasser to be withheld in the occupation's mortuaries.
A general strike and a day of anger and mourning has been declared in the occupied Ramallah and other West Bank areas following the death of Nasser. Here at Al-Amari refugee camp where Nasser lived, protests have taken place with hundreds of Palestinian fighters participating. Nasser has left behind him 4 imprisoned siblings, also serving consecutive life sentences. He joined his brother Abdul Hamid, who was killed by Israeli forces in 2002.
Nasser has joined the martyrs' convoy, and we are all on the same path. Today, all the Palestinians are sad for his death. He was a resistance leader. I don't say so because he was my brother. Since he was a teenager, he used to fight against the Israeli soldiers. He was always among the first fighters in every operation.
Israeli authorities continue their crimes of medical negligence of Palestinian prisoners in violation of all international laws. First, they kidnapped prisoners and kept them behind bars for lengthy years. Then they refuse to offer them appropriate medications until they die, while they refuse to release their bodies, an act that represents other forms of crimes.
233 Palestinian prisoners died in Israeli jails since 1967, many of them because of medical negligence. Israel today withholds in its mortuaries the bodies of 11 prisoners, including Nasser Abu Ahmed.
Even after his martyrdom in Israeli jails, the Tel Aviv regime continues to withhold Nasser Abu Ahmed's body, a move Palestinians say is meant to punish his family, who say he has the right to a decent funeral procession and burial. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Japan's decision to boost its military spending has drawn strong rebukes from civic leaders in South Korea. Tokyo argues its move to build up its forces comes amid threats from North Korea and China. Tokyo's arms purchases will also provide a boon for U.S. weapons producers. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
That's a wrap for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The capitals of European countries have been the scene of protests and strikes in recent days. Protesters demand a freeze on spiking energy prices and better pay amid high inflation in the continent. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Euronews reported over 15,000 demonstrators braved the bitter cold in Brussels recently to call for more measures to shield them from high energy prices and better pay to counter runaway inflation. The protests, backed by the three main unions, disrupted public services throughout Belgium, especially rail and subway systems in and around the capital, as well as Brussels International Airport. With people increasingly under pressure from high prices, the unions demanded pay increases at a time when companies such as energy giants are making massive profits. They are asking for a freeze in energy prices and increased taxation on capital. The union said in a statement, "We won't stop unless workers get what they deserve." Meanwhile, demonstrators in several cities across Italy took to the streets after two of the country's largest unions, CGIL and UIL, staged a one-day walkout. They protested the government's 2023 general budget, which they say does not account for loss of purchasing power due to inflation. In London, the job satisfaction of the railway workers who have begun another 48 hours of industrial action has long since been derailed. Backed by RMT Union, this is the sector's second two-day strike so far this week, and it looks like it will not be the last of this year. In France, train controllers who are threatening to strike during the Christmas and New Year's holidays have until Monday to respond to a proposed wage increase from management. Teacher Maria Nemes told Euronews, "I just don't understand why the government treats us like criminals. I love my students, I love my colleagues, and I love my high school." Nemes is one of more than a dozen Hungarian teachers who have been sacked for civil disobedience. The 50-year-old English teacher was dismissed with immediate effect in November after protesting the decision of local authorities to fire some fellow teachers for staging a walkout. Anger among teachers has bubbled away for years over low wages and grueling working hours, but new strike laws have pushed them into open conflict with the government. Budapest vowed to give teachers a pay rise in the next 3 years last month. Industrial action has swept through the sector, triggering rafts of dismissals and large protests that have taken on an anti-government flavor. In December, Katrini Frigyes High School in Budapest was forced to close because so many teachers were sacked or absent. Their number was below the legal minimum. Meanwhile, an extraordinary break was ordered at Vorosmarty Secondary School after 90% of the teaching staff refused to return to work following the dismissal of a colleague. Even before the cost of living crisis, Hungarian teachers felt underpaid, earning approximately 520 to 560 euros per month after more than a decade on the job. In comparison, the average price of an apartment in Budapest is 400 to 600 euros. Inflation in Hungary is currently 22.5%, which is among the highest in the EU. In January, one junior teacher wrote a damning open letter to Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Despite working 57 hours a week, he was left with 98 euros to live on a month after paying rent and bills, eating only rice or pasta, and often having to bring toilet paper home from his school. Meanwhile, Tasnim News Agency wrote, National Health Service, NHS nurses in Britain have staged and will stage another strike in their first ever national walkout as a bitter dispute with the government over pay ramps up pressure on already stretched hospitals at one of the busiest times of the year. An estimated 100,000 nurses will walk out of their jobs at 76 hospitals and health centres across Britain, cancelling thousands of non-urgent operations such as hip replacements and tens of thousands of outpatient appointments in Britain's state-funded NHS, Reuters reported. Britain is facing a wave of industrial action this winter, with the strikes crippling the rail network and postal service and airports bracing for disruptions over Christmas. Inflation is running at more than 10%, trailed by pay offers of around 4%. This is stoking tensions between unions and employers. Of all the strikes, though, it will be the sight of nurses on picket lines that will be the standout image for many Britons this winter.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK has been accused of a cover-up during the time that they were involved in the Afghanistan war. A new inquiry launched into how the SAS soldiers killed Afghan civilians dated back to the year 2010. Now, what is worse is that this involves more than 50 summary killings by the SAS soldiers. And even worse yet, it came when for years there were reports that elite British troops killed civilians in cold blood, which meant that they were aware of it, authorities higher up. Why was this covered up is the first question, and more importantly, why would the British soldiers do that? Were there orders from the top down? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce them. Farah Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joins us from Kitchener, Ontario. Welcome to you both. Frahis, I'll first start with you. So we have the nature of the crime, as it's been said, which is much more extensive than this, but this is an inquiry that's being held again on more than 50, what we understand, summary killings by the SAS soldiers, 54, according to what has been revealed. And it happened in Helmand province between the years 2010 and 11, of which the conclusion was that this amounted to war crimes. What is your immediate reaction to this, something, again, that's been reopened to follow through in order to perhaps get some prosecution, if that is at all possible?
Firstly, I don't think there'll be any prosecutions whatsoever. If you consider that this is already a decade after these war crimes and murders, extrajudicial executions have been carried out, and it's only now that the second investigation is underway. The people in Afghanistan will never receive justice. The only justice they had was at the bayonet points of the British soldiers that had gone halfway around the world to oppress and subdue the Afghan people. As you introduced me, I live in Belfast in Ireland, and we all here know about British war crimes. In 1971, on the 9th of August, when the British reintroduced internment without trial, the British paratroopers run amok in Belfast on the 9th of August 1971 and murdered 11 people in what were called the Spring Hill Ballymurphy massacres. The inquests have only taken part last year, 50 years after those people were brutally cut down, people who were unarmed, including
Why does it take so long, though? Why does that take that long for this to be even covered and then, you know, perhaps, again, with, as you said, not in prosecution to take place?
Well, it's part of the cover-up. You see, if you don't have an inquest, then there's no accountability as to how the people died. The British government and indeed the British Army claimed that these people were armed, that these were terrorists, that these were insurrectionists, people who died in gun battles, which is all lies, and it's all propaganda, and it's all cover-up. And in fact, 6 months after these murders in Belfast, we had 13 unarmed civil rights protesters murdered in Derry on what was called Bloody Sunday on the 30th of January, right, 1972. And the gentleman who was in charge of that was then later went on to become the general officer commanding of British Land Forces, A soldier one day becomes the general officer commanding several years later after committing war crimes in the streets of Derry.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start out with a general description of a couple of the, first the general, overview, Robert Fantina, of what was disclosed. And then we're going to get into a couple cases, if not three, if we have the time, of the nature of the crimes that were committed. Because that needs to be... unfortunately or fortunately, reviewed here so that you can grasp the gravity of the crime that was committed. First, in terms of the overall view, from the evidence and disclosures required by the court, it says that the Afghan man detained by these SAS soldiers were during night raids, and they were often separated from their families, and they were shot dead. This was routine, where the troops... then went and planted weapons on them to justify the crimes. So that's an overall view of what happened. The question is, why would they subscribe, these SAA soldiers, to such a method?
There are a few reasons. One is that they were given orders by their superiors and supervisors to do this, to terrorize the population by killing the men in their, or pulling them out of their homes and killing them. So terrorize the population to subdue them and prevent any kind of resistance to the invading forces could have been ordered by their leaders. The other reason is simply that these soldiers, many soldiers in the United States, UK, and other places, are trained to kill. That is what they do. That is their job. And so they see anybody and they will kill them. They also, there is... discrimination against the people of Afghan. Afghanistan is not a Christian country, it's mainly a Muslim country. And in the West, Muslims are seen as different and dangerous. And so the soldiers who are accused of killing, who allegedly killed these civilians, were probably part of, or felt that same way, that these people weren't worthy of life the same way as they were, and therefore they were free to kill them. Now, this is what we see in war frequently, so it's nothing new. The fact that it's been exposed or it's being investigated after all these years simply tells us that the British government doesn't take it all that seriously.
Well, let's take a look at a more graphic example here. And I'm sorry if it bothers you. I do apologize right now. But, Frahius, I'm going to go ahead and ask you anyways, because this is one of the things that is pretty much an eye-opener, where you have an instance of two Afghan children where... It is, again, citing this source, at 8 p.m., you have the British and Afghan soldiers. They burst into a home, a 12-year-old boy and a 14-year-old who were staying there overnight were taken. And a witness said, when I entered the room afterwards, I saw bones and teeth all over the place. There were four altogether. The four of them were lying there, blood everywhere. Is that what SAA soldiers are trained to do?
I think brutality goes along with the mindset of people who are trained, specifically these special air service personnel. They're trained not to take prisoners. They're trained to torture people. They're trained to gather information, and they're trained to terrorize the local population. You don't have to go any further than, was it Abu Ghraib, when you see what happened in the prison with the torture, with prisoners that were naked, that were attacked by dogs. The dehumanization of other races and other religions and other nations is part and parcel of like Western imperialism. So, the brutality, there'll be nobody held to account. And these people will just basically get away with murder, and the victims and their families will never get any closure. And, let's not forget what's happening in Yemen. Let's not forget what's happening in Syria and in Libya. This is happening all over West Asia and further afield.
Sure.
And the brutality that we witnessed in Ukraine as well from the fascists there. It's a mindset, and unfortunately, no one's held the account.
You mentioned a very key phrase there, Robert Fantina, and you said that this may be, or that this is, how orders have been handed from the top down, which is why it's executed by these special soldiers. And I found a sentence where it's interesting, where it said that it's the sort of violence that occurs in a war where brutality is encouraged from the top down. And then it went on to say Britain's whole occupation is built on it. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Britain has a long history as a colonial nation of 100 years. And throughout its that colonial history, it's been very violent. Look what the British did in India and other places. So violence is always part of war. It's always part of colonialism and occupation. We can look at what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians and have been for decades now. Violent, oppressive, cruel, really inhumane. And these are the components of war and of occupation. They simply come with the territory, and they are all criminal. They're all crimes against humanity. They're all war crimes. But countries, governments continue to perpetrate them, or perpetuate them, I should say, and we don't see them being held to account in really any circumstances whatsoever.
This not being held to account is what the problem is, which I believe leads to, if you agree, Farah Hughes, to this being committed on a repeated case. I mean, when you take a look at what has been revealed, where the UK was aware for years about these SAS soldiers and their basically committing war crimes, but criminal investigations were closed without any prosecutions to be brought forward, then that kind of is a green light for them to continue it in any other war scenario or any other scenario. It may not even involve a war scenario. Why would years of reports actually not be investigated, do you think?
Well, I think there's several parts to this, and one of them would be that the British government does not want the British people to know what's being done in their name by their army and by their special air services. And the other one is, we in the north of Ireland have gone through our own kind of post-conflict amnesty. The British government last year actually is bringing onto the statute books a law that would give amnesty to war crimes carried out by British personnel over the 30 years of the conflict here in the north of Ireland. And it's been suggested that the amnesty would be more wide-ranging than the amnesty that was offered by Pinochet to cover human rights violations in Chile when he was in charge, and Queen's University in Belfast and the Committee for the Administration of Justice have both said that this amnesty proposed by the British government on behalf of the British armed forces would go much further than another 300 post-conflict amnesties. So what we have is not only no accountability and British soldiers being above the law, but now the law is going to be changed in order to protect them from war crimes. And if I was in Afghanistan, I would actually be bringing cases before the ICC, the International Criminal Court, in The Hague, rather than try and get justice from the British government when none will be forthcoming.
Well, we have a situation here, Robert Frentino, where it's pretty interesting. You have the UK Ministry of Defence that created what was called and I'm going to move to another war scenario, and it's called the other war that the UK was involved in, which was based on the false premise of supposed weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which that never turned out to be the case. They actually created a ministry called the Iraq, not a ministry, but a team called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, where it looked into accusations of abuse committed by the British in Iraq now, between the years 2003 and 2006. And then they discovered some 280 victims of alleged unlawful killings and 1,235 cases of ill treatment, which included rape and torture. And then you have the government come up with a UK MP's committee, which said, you know what, that's not true, that can't be right. And they said it's an unstoppable self-perpetuating machine, deaf to the concerns of the armed forces, and that it had to be shut down. How do you explain that?
This is only explained by the fact that the UK government, like many or most other governments, doesn't want to be constrained in any way by going to war wherever they choose to go. And as your other commentator mentioned, they want their people to think of the military and members of the military as noble and going around the world to help people. This, of course, is a huge lie and a complete myth. They don't want them to know the savagery that these soldiers commit on a regular basis. Now, the fact that the UK established a committee, identified war crimes, crimes against humanity, and then simply, with the stroke of a pen, voided those findings is beyond appalling. The innocent victims receive no closure, there can be no compensation for loss of life. Nothing will compensate for that. But there's no accountability, and this just leaves the military, it gives the military free rein to commit whatever crimes it wants to in the future. So soldiers know from this that anything they do, they will not be held accountable for, and there's no limit to the cruelty they can inflict on their victims.
So let's take a look at some of the wars, and let's pick the two that really stands out, I think, for our Hughes, and the one in Afghanistan, obviously, and then, of course, the Iraq War. If you were to take a look at the way that the countries involved and their soldiers, how they acted in such a way, and I'm not talking about all of them, but obviously a portion of them that acted in the way that they did, where obviously violations of human rights was taking place at a minimum based on some of the ruling acts that have taken place, and I'm being very soft on calling it a violation of human rights. Didn't that contribute to the war itself to be lost and for the for there not to be a success, particularly, for example, when we take a look at Afghanistan, 20 years there, and you had UK soldiers, you had soldiers from ISAF, you had U.S. soldiers, but they didn't, as the one general once said, they wanted to win the hearts and minds, and they didn't. I believe it was the former General Flynn. It's because of these types of acts. Wasn't that a contributory to them not winning the war overall?
Yes, they've used violent repression in order to stop resistance. So what they've done is they've invaded against the will of the Afghan and Iraqi people. The people have reacted and resisted this foreign military intervention and occupation. And in order to stop and try to prevent the resistance, then they bring about more repression, more fear, more murders, more torture, more violence. And the more that they use that, the more people react. If you kill someone in cold blood who's innocent and unarmed, their brother, their friend, their son, it's not about revenge. People will just at some point say, this is not acceptable, and in order to stop this, we must make these foreign invaders leave our country. But the fact is that Britain and America and the other people involved in this, they tried hearts and minds here in Ireland as well. It's nothing more than propaganda, giving sweets to children, visiting people in hospital, trying to bring aid and succor and comfort to people in small communities. It's all PR, it's all propaganda, it's all a manipulation of the reality of what's happening on the ground. And, you know, from the day in our, any colonial power goes in and occupies any sovereign nation, there will always be resistance, and that resistance normally always wins. It's just a matter of time, be it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or in the case of Ireland, 800 years. But eventually, sure, People will fight and receive their freedom.
Indeed. Well, you have instances where, Robert Fantina, you have the accusations and then the proof that is out there, but yet the governments, the respective governments, don't want to follow through with the prosecution. In the case of the UK, since we've put some focus on that, even the ICC Court of The Hague has said hundreds of Iraqis, in terms of their testimonies, showed a pattern of beatings, sleep and sensory deprivation, stress positions, deprivation of food and water, sexual and religious humiliation, and what have you. Kind of sounds like a rap sheet for the American soldiers in Abu Ghraib and what they did there. When this happens and so much time has gone by, doesn't this mean when the prosecutions are not there that there's a flaw in the system and that needs to be rectified? But then who do you go to do that? Because obviously these soldiers or whoever that's committing these war crimes are, they're immune to it. They're being shielded by the governments.
It's not a flaw in the system. The system is working the way the governments want it to work. They want to avoid and evade, push out the timeline investigation. Hopefully people forget. Hopefully the stories will and then they can sweep these atrocities under the rug and commit them again. Now, these new investigation that has launched or is in early next year will be probably another show, some testimony given, some witnesses, and then minor findings may be determined or decided upon that there were some abuses here and there, but nothing that was typical. And then there might be one or two soldiers getting a slap on the wrist. But the people who are really responsible, the lead held accountable, and they will be free, commit these crimes against humanity again and again and again, simply because, as I said, this is the way for the governments. They want this free reign to do whatever they choose in whenever they're involved in a foreign invasion, and holding people accountable for their crimes against humanity would constrain them. It's as it should work, but it's not how the governments want it to work, so they have set up the system so that there will be no accountability.
Sure. Well, I can't help but look back as our guest there was talking, Frahuz, and get your thoughts on what was called the Chilcot Inquiry, where you had the case of this, as I mentioned before, in terms of the false notion of WMDs in Iraq, and yet you have the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair or the former US President George Bush Jr. who have walked scot-free and they've been responsible for so many deaths. And still the remnants of that war are echoing in the hospital chambers of people who are suffering from nuclear remnants from ammunition that was used that was tainted with nuclear material. I mean, it's just something not right about this.
Yes, you're probably referring to the massacre in Fallujah where they used depleted uranium. I mean, Tony Blair, in my mind, is a war criminal, and so is Bush, and all the deaths that occurred are all about foreign Western corporations going in and taking oil and gas and gold and whatever else it is that they took. And in Iraq, didn't they take millions, if not billions, of gold, pounds worth and dollars worth of gold bars that were that were in Iraq? And then on top of that, we can see through all this pain that still continues today. I mean, there's still landmines. There are still people losing their legs on a frequent basis in these countries from all the landmines that have been kind of abandoned all over the country in order to inflict further pain and torment kind of post-conflict after the war has been resolved. But there weren't only, you know, victims in Iraq and Afghanistan. You mentioned the Chilcot report, and it made me think straight away of David Kelly. David Kelly was the British scientist who was claimed to have sexed up the dossier in order to make it appear that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was the excuse used for the war. He walked off out into the woods near his home and didn't come back. They said he committed suicide. But in the film, The Killing of Kelly by George Galloway, there are persistent rumors that he was murdered. So the British government didn't just murder people in Iraq and Afghanistan. They quite possibly murdered a British scientist in order to cover up what he might have told any future inquiry as to how they came about with this whole notion of the weapons of mass destruction as an excuse to invade Iraq.
Sure. Looking down the road here, Robert Fantino, quickly, if you can answer this, are we looking at pretty much the status quo to continue? Based on the fact that you're not getting the prosecutions that these cases deserve for any future endeavors in the war scenario that in particular the U.S. may be involved with or the U.K., because usually they're, you know, work with this special relationship they have hand in hand.
Yes, and most of the wars on the planet do involve the United States in one way or another. And yes, sadly, we are going to see a maintenance of the status quo. There will be some, as I mentioned before, some minor findings from this current investigation, as there were from U.S. investigations about abuses in Iraq. But then the next war, we'll see the same kinds of crimes, same kinds of cover-ups, and the same kinds of pseudo-investigations. When you have the British government investigating its own soldiers or the U.S. government investigating its own soldiers, that is not an impartial judge. There needs to be these things need to go to the ICC so that they can be viewed impartially. Otherwise, we're going to see the same continually.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it, Robert Fantino, author and journalist. Frahuz, thank you so much. Journalist, author, and activist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoba Tahoe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From our Imams, the ninth Imam is the first, whose Imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And His Eminence Imam al-Jawad was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him. We find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam economized when it came to spending upon himself. He lived a rather ascetic, simple lifestyle. But His Eminence Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam spent a great abundant amount of wealth on the poor and the needy people amongst the Muslims. And it is precisely because of this unequaled and unparalleled generosity that Imam al-Jawad has been called and titled Al-Jawad, the Generous. This surname was the most particular and famous surname of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, to the extent that he was well known and famous for it amongst the people. ¶¶
parts of Ziyarat text of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ayyuha an-nur as-sati. As-salamu alayka ayyuha al-badr al-tali.
Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Aba Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. In one of the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence speaks about blessings. Now, of course, there are many blessings in our life that we have, but for some reason in the hustle and bustle of the world, we tend to forget about these blessings, and for large part, we are ungrateful regarding these blessings. But of course, the blessings that we receive from Allah are all-encompassing, and we must take time out in our daily lives in order to reflect about these blessings that the Almighty Allah has given us. And of course, this will include us to be among the grateful servants of Allah. When asked about blessings from one of his companions, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam replies to him saying, Allah has some people whom he singles out with his divine blessings. And these blessings are still with them as long as they spend from them upon the people, especially the needy people. But if they prevent these blessings, then Allah takes them back from them and gives them to another person. Here, dear friends, we realize at times that really we have been blessed by the Almighty Allah and that we have so many blessings in our lives. Now, sometimes Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, the All-Wise, the All-Knowing, He blesses certain people with certain blessings. One such blessing is the blessing of having wealth or financial blessing. But here we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam is telling us that this abundance of this blessing of wealth that Allah has given us, or for that matter, a station or status or position or power, these things that Allah has given us in abundance should be used in order to help the other servants of Allah, the other believers, and the other Muslims. Whenever we can, either via our wealth or our power or our status or our station or our influence, we should help our fellow Muslim brothers and sisters. Now, the reason that Allah has given us an abundance in these kind of blessings, blessings from which we can help other Muslim brothers and sisters, is so that we help these other Muslim brothers and sisters. And so as Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam replied to his companion, he said that if we do not use these blessings that Allah has given us in order for us to give them to other people, then Allah takes those blessings away from us and gives those blessings to one